Culture Rich Conversations on Juno Afternoon is sponsored in part by Mark Stofa and Sarah Hannon of the Alaska Wild Salmon Company, delivering fresh salmon to Juno homes since 2006. Learn more at goodsalmon.com or 907-321-4997.
You're listening to Culture Rich. Culture Rich.
Welcome to Culture Rich Conversations. Today's show is a collaboration between KTOO and the Black Awareness Association of Juno. I'm your host, Christina Michelle, and I'm here with Natasha Boozer, who is our guest today, and we will be talking about critical race theory. Welcome, Natasha.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be back again to talk with you.
I'm excited to have you. And can you just tell us where you are calling from today?
Yes, I'm calling from Las Vegas, Nevada.
And how's the weather in Vegas? Because over here, it is snowing and about 38 degrees.
Right now, it's a little chilly, but not as chilly as where you are. I would say it's about 55, 60 degrees.
Oh my gosh, that's perfect weather. That's perfect winter weather. Well, I'm glad that you're a lot warmer than we are, and I'm really glad to have you here. And we got a lot of feedback from our listeners about some of the stories that you shared with us about just the challenges that your family has had around race and living on two different coasts, living on the East Coast versus the West Coast, and just some of the things that you have gone through. I mean, one of those big things that stuck out was the time that you talked about your husband having the police called on him by the neighbors in your neighborhood because there had been a prowler taking people's mail. And can you just recap that really quick?
Yes. So what actually happened was he went out to check the mail early in the morning. And in that neighborhood where we lived, you visited there. It's a regular suburb. And most of the men in that neighborhood wore hoodies and sweatpants to like go jogging, go for walks. So his attire, it matched what everyone else wore in the neighborhood. It wasn't different. And so he went to go check the mail. And then he came in through the backyard to throw away his junk mail and then came into the kitchen. And it was me, my young daughter at the time, and my husband. And I went into the kitchen to get some food, and I saw a police officer at the back window in the kitchen with a gun pointed at me. And I was like, is there a prank happening? Is there a movie that I didn't know being filmed? And I was very confused. And so I went to the door, and I was like, hello? And the officer, you know, had his gun pointed, and I had my hands up because I didn't know what else to do with them. And he said, you know, open the door. And I said, okay, put your gun down and I'll let you in, because what else am I supposed to say? And so he came in, and I turned around to my husband and I said, there's this officer here with a gun. And he stood there and he said, okay. And then the officer came in, he said, we heard there was someone stealing mail from people's mailbox, and they came into this house. And I said, well, we live here and we didn't steal anyone's mail. And he asked for our ID. So I went to go get our licenses. It had our address of our residence on it. And when I turned back around, three more came into my kitchen, and I was like, there's more of you. And he said that the house is surrounded. And I heard an officer saying, cancel the helicopter. And I was like, there's a helicopter?
Oh my gosh.
And I was very confused. And it was very frightening because, you know, what I understand now is that if my husband had still been in the backyard, they may have tackled him, arrested him, assaulted him, and asked questions later. I only believe that it was because of the grace of God that we didn't lose our lives that day. And I'm very thankful for that. But we did find out from a neighbor that we spoke with later on that another neighbor lived behind us had called the police and said there was a Black man going around stealing people's mail. And she had called that neighbor, and the neighbor was like, well, a new Black couple has moved in to that house. And she goes, well, I called them anyway. And that's how I knew what happened, because I had insider information, because otherwise I never would have known. So fast forward quickly, a few weeks later, we got a letter in the mail from the local police station giving us a citation for making a false police call. And I called them and I said, we did not call you. Someone else made a false police call. That was not us. Can you please cancel the citation? And we never got an apology. We never had any closure where that was concerned. And it was very traumatic, very upsetting. And I do believe that if we had not been of brown and black skin, she never would have called the police on us. And it was very disappointing and upsetting that that happened to us, but it definitely was a life lesson in the end.
Was there actually someone stealing mail, or did they just assume that when your husband was checking the mail that it wasn't his?
Yeah, there was no one stealing mail.
Okay.
No, there was no one stealing mail. I asked, and I even spoke to the owners of our house. We rented that house. I spoke to the owners who owned the house, and they said the house, it's not a bad neighborhood. That, and they knew who the person was, that she was a very nosy, racist neighbor.
Wow. Well, I am so glad that you guys lived through that and that no one was at least physically hurt. And thank you for sharing that story with us again. And I just appreciate you being here with us. And we are going to talk about a hot topic today. It's critical race theory. And I am just excited to get into this because it's something that I am learning more about. It's something that a lot of our listeners probably have heard about, but there's probably a lot of people who don't know about it. And so you are the perfect person to bring us all up to speed and to shed some light on this conversation. So thank you, Natasha.
You're welcome. Before we get started, I wanted to make sure that I give a little disclaimer. I want to make sure that we establish the foundation of facts. And I want to make sure that we firmly state the definition of critical race theory and what it is and where it is taught. I want to make sure we clearly state what critical race theory is not and where it is not taught. This is important because there's people who believe falsehoods and rumors and have not had the time or taken the opportunity to learn the truth. Once that has been achieved, I think we can have an honest discussion. The purpose is not to shame or alienate anyone at all, but to shine a light on the truth so that we can heal and make progress and move forward as a nation. A lot of lies that were told and are still being told is what keep us divided, not speaking on racism, but lying and covering it up. So I want to make sure that we know that from the very beginning.
Thank you very much. Well, can you start off and just tell us what is critical race theory?
Yes. So a lot of information that I gathered, or some of it rather, came from a journalist that had done the hard work for me so that I could speak with you today. And his name is Elliot C. McLaughlin, and all of his work is cited in fact checked. So when I give definitions, that's where my information came from, just from the beginning. So critical race theory conducts a legal analysis that sees race as a culturally invented category used to oppress people of color and also seeks to expose the laws and legal institutions in the United States that are inherently racist, so much so that they function to create and maintain social, political, and economic inequalities between white and non-white people. So basically, it talks about systemic racism in America, not just by individuals, but by institutions and laws as well.
Okay, thank you for breaking that down for me, because I don't know that I would have a good definition for it, like a succinct one at least. And I asked a couple people as I was getting ready to have this conversation with you today, and I came away more confused than I was before I asked them. Everybody had a different definition, and it was all kind of fuzzy and murky. And it ended with, you don't know what critical race theory is. You need to go look it up. And I'm like, okay, I just want to know what you thought it was and what your views on it were.
Yes.
So, that's okay. So why is this a thing right now? Because I'm going to be honest, I really have not heard a lot about critical race theory, or CRT, as I've learned it's abbreviated. And somehow it seems like it has surfaced or maybe resurfaced. I don't know if, you know, I've had my head in the sand or something, but like, why is it a thing right now?
So I can tell you how I found out about it. So I learned back with the previous administration that critical race theory was taught in law schools for law students, and it was partially funded by the government. And at some point under Trump's administration, he decided to stop funding it. And that happened near around the time the Black Lives Matter protests began. And so it became a talking point. And I didn't know what it was, so I looked it up. And the more that I learned about it, the more I was in awe of why it became a huge topic when normally you only hear about this topic when you are a student, a law student, and it's a class that you take in your educational studies. So it's not something that you or I or most people would even really know about it.
Okay, that makes sense. So can you tell us if you know or what you know about the history of critical race theory and why it was developed in the first place?
Yes, critical race theory was developed in the 1970s as an effort by activists and legal scholars to understand and study how bigotry and bias infiltrated American institutions and began to shape American life. They wanted to know why the U.S. civil rights movement had lost momentum and was in danger of being reversed. Their approach emphasized general and systemic features of the legal system that served to perpetuate race-based oppression and white privilege. So they wanted to find out the root of why civil rights movement didn't bring us forward and farther along from a legal standpoint, and why it wasn't just individuals, but rather whole institutions that were discovered to be part of the problem instead of assisting in a solution. And the solution being civil and equal rights for all minorities. You know, there are conservatives and Republicans that falsely claim that racism and systemic racism is perpetuated by individuals rather than institutions. And they deny the laws that existed purposefully to oppress Black and brown people.
Okay. And so why is there such a big uproar now about it if it's something that most people didn't even know about in the first place?
From what I can understand, I think it became a huge talking point politically. I think that if certain politicians hadn't picked up on it and ran with it as a way to run for office, then most of us would never know about it. I think it became something that the Republicans and conservatives decided to stand up on and say, oh, we're going to make sure that your kids aren't learning CRT and aren't being indoctrinated. Vote for me and I'll take care of your kids. I won't make your children feel guilty about American history. I'll make sure that that patriotism is taught and not this crazy theory that the left liberals want you to believe. And I think that they just ran with that, and there was never a person on that side that said, hey, this is not what that is. You're going in the wrong direction. I think they just had the loudest voices. And even though people stood up and said, this is not correct, this is not what this means, they still ran with it. And there were campaigns that were fully ran on CRT and nothing else.
So what do you think the threat is?
If I'm being honest, I think the threat is that if Black and brown people learn the truth about how systemic racism truly is, not just individuals, but whole institutions that impose that racism upon Black and brown people and can use that to oppress people, then they would see the way that they want to live, not white people, but racist people. They would see their lives changed and upended. And they don't want that. They want to, people who have power want to keep their power. They don't want to be held accountable for the mistakes that maybe they made. Maybe they have changed. Maybe they enjoy the life they live right now. And I think that that's why racism is still flourishing. It flourishes because there are people who still benefit from it and they want to keep benefiting from it. They don't want to be held accountable. They don't want to change their way of life because it's comfortable for them. So why should they? And if they can continue to oppress people and continue to make people believe that what they're seeing as truth is a lie, they can keep living the life they want to live.
Wow. Can you paint a picture of, in your opinion, what looks different if the critical race theory, if it advances and if people really do learn the truth? What changes for racist people and what changes for Black and brown people?
I think that Black and brown people would gain more power and be more liberated to fight for the freedom that we've been fighting for since the beginning of American history. I think that they would understand that they do have power and they do have rights and they can band together and change the culture in a way that uplifts everybody, not just a minority who is minority because of color of skin, but because of their sexual preference or because of their gender, and because it includes all of that. And I think as far as racism is concerned, I think they would see that they are now the minority, that they are now the ones who are less in number, and that they would have to be held accountable, that they would have to be their way of life brought to the forefront and see what you're doing is wrong, what you're doing is oppressive, and what you're doing is actually what divides us, not us speaking up for ourselves, not us protesting for what is right, not us standing up for our rights and for what is right, but the fact that you continue to oppress us. I hope that that day comes. I think that for my children, for the children that are in school right now, I think if they can learn the truth, then they will be able to shape American society in a different way and bring it in a much better way. But we still have a long way to go.
So critical race theory is not something that is taught in schools. Is that correct?
Right.
So what is the difference between the Black history that is taught in schools and critical race theory? And do you think that CRT should be integrated into school systems?
Yes. So the difference between critical race theory and the Black history that is taught in schools today is that critical race theory basically recognizes that systemic racism is part of American society, and it challenges the beliefs that allow that racism to flourish. Now, the Black history that is taught in schools is a variation, depending on the school district, of the chronological timeline of Black history, beginning with slavery and colonialism through to civil rights movement, and moves forward to establishing equal rights for all Americans. So there is a difference, clearly. The curriculum of Black and brown Americans taught in schools is supposed to be done in a way that simply reviews and teaches the true evolution of American history, while critical race theory is only taught in law schools and only for students studying and majoring in law. It is an in-depth study focused on race being a social construct and systemic racism and oppression with respect to the laws and legal institutions in America.
And in your opinion, do you think that CRT is something that should be taught in schools?
No, because if you look at what it actually is, it is curated specifically for law students. It is not, there is no curriculum as far as critical race theory is concerned for elementary school and middle school and high school. I think what needs to truly be done is for American history to be taught properly in elementary schools, middle schools, and high schools. And if that is done, there would be no need to put critical race theory in schools, because you would have to have students who were interested in law school and would then further their education with critical race theory.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So you homeschool your children, is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Kudos to you for that. I don't know how you do it, but
it's very hard. A lot of prayer.
So what do you teach your children about Black history in America? Or do
what
you?
A great question. I do. Thank you so much for asking me that question. So I have a second grader and a seventh grader. So they don't learn exactly the same thing. But for my daughter, for Grace, I teach her about Martin Luther King Jr. and we touch on slavery. And I teach her to be proud of her brown skin, to be proud of her hair, to be proud of her body, and to be proud of her heritage. So we lay a foundation of pride into who she is and where she came from and how she looks. With Moses, we did that as well. So we've done a little every year and building on that foundation. Right now, he is in seventh grade, and he also was aware of what happened with George Floyd, and he had questions. And so what I do is I give him the facts and I tell him the truth, but I also equip him with the tools to handle the violent history of Black history. And I equip him with the knowledge that one day he may be looked at not for who he is, but for what he represents to a racist person. And it is not easy to have that conversation because he's such a bright, wonderful individual. And I work very hard to build up his self-esteem as a young Black man. And I teach him that he is strong and that he is educated and that he is smart and that he should work hard to do the things that he wants to do in his life. But I also make it clear that there are systems in place that may make it difficult for him to do the things he wants to do in life that are rooted in racism. And I tell him that now because I want him to be prepared to know what to do. I spoke on this before, I think, with my husband about when he's driving in a car with other people and he gets pulled over. And I said, what you do is you put your driver's license, your insurance and registration on your lap. You put your hands on the wheel and you speak respectfully and calmly to the approaching officer, even if you've done nothing wrong, because I want my son. Ooh, am I going to cry? No. Okay. I want my son to come home to me. And I tell him that, you know, he's like, well, why do I have to do that? And I said, because racism exists and there are people who don't get to come home. So I do tell my children the truth. I do educate them on the facts and I educate them on the way racist people will see them because of their own beliefs, even if those beliefs are wrong. And what our job is to protect ourselves. It's not to shrink as Black and brown people, but it is to protect ourselves to come home at night.
Wow. You can answer this if you want to. If you don't, please don't feel like you have to. But how does your husband play a role in educating your son as a Black man, as a Black adult?
Yes. So that's a great question as well. He tells my son about his own personal experiences. We waited a very long time to share that story about the police coming to our house. We waited until he was about 12, and it happened when he was in second grade. And we didn't want, because we knew he would cry and be upset. And he was upset when we told him, but he was in a better mental place to handle the truth, even though it was upsetting to him. But my husband teaches him what it means to be a Black man in America and also how racist Americans see immigrants. My husband was born in Jamaica and he immigrated to this country when he was 15 with a green card. And he got his citizenship when Moses was 4 or 5, I think. So after he was 30. And so I love that I have a husband who's an immigrant, even though it's Jamaica, but I love that I have that in our family because my son gets to see both sides. He gets to see the whole picture, not just one side. My husband teaches him about police brutality and about going to the bank to deposit money, going to the grocery store. My husband drove for Lyft when we first moved to Las Vegas, and he would dress as if he was going to a corporate job every day. He wore a nice dress shirt, sometimes a jacket. You know, he wore dress shoes. He didn't dress in sweats and a sweatshirt or a hoodie. He made himself look professional even though his job was to drive for Lyft for a short time. And he did that because he wanted to represent himself in a way, unfortunately, that did not seem threatening to any passenger that was not a person of color. Because he knew that if the person coming in his car felt threatened in any way, that could affect him negatively. And it wasn't easy. And my husband shares that with our son. He's 13 now, almost 14, if you can believe that. And it's important that my son understands the way our society is set up and the way that Black men are treated in this country. And even though my husband is very dark-skinned and my son is very light-skinned, it doesn't make a difference. Even though they should be treated as individuals and not based upon a racist belief because of the color of their skin, they still are. And it serves my son better to know the truth as early as possible than to wait and let him experience it on his own.
You want your son to be educated and to know the truth about the history of the country that he lives in and how many people see Black and brown people. But I would think that you don't want him to be jaded or bitter, right? Like, I would imagine that. Or is that not even an issue, right? It's like...
It is. Okay. So this is what I will say to that. So one of the things that I noticed when I started reading the 1619 Project was that I started to feel some kind of way, as we say, about white people. And I had to pray for myself because I knew what I was reading was an accounting of history. And I already knew that it is racist people, not all white people, who caused such violent harm to Black and brown people, right? And so I teach my son, and he understood this, but I teach my son that even though we live in a culture that a minority of racist people have caused our society to be in a racist society, that most people are not racist. And just because you have an experience with a racist person does not mean that they speak for their entire race, right? So we know that there are racist people, but not all white people are racist. And I reiterate that to him whenever he asks me questions like, Mom, how are you able to, you know, have white friends? And I'm like, because my friends are not racist. And the people that I call my friends are not racist. Just because a person's a white person does not make them racist. Just like a person who has brown skin does not make them whatever stereotype a racist person wants to paint on that color of skin. And I continue to teach him that so that he understands to judge a person based on how they treat him and not the color of their skin. Because that's what we do as adults.
That's beautiful. Thank you, Natasha. If you're just joining us, I'm Christina Michelle, your host today, and I'm interviewing Natasha Boozer, and she is here educating us about critical race theory, the importance of it, the history of it, and we're going to go ahead and take a break here, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Culture Rich Conversations. I'm your host, Christina Michelle, and today's show is a collaboration between KTOO and the Black Awareness Association of Juneau. I'm joined here today by Natasha Boozer. She is calling in from Las Vegas, Nevada. Welcome back, Natasha.
Thank you for having me.
One thing I forgot to mention earlier is that you actually are from Juneau, raised in Juneau.
Yes, that's correct. I came to Juneau when I was 8 years old, and I left when I was 18.
So we're talking about critical race theory here, and we've learned a lot so far. And you've shared about some of your experiences, you know, on the East Coast and there on the West Coast. And I was wondering if you have any thoughts about critical race theory and how it applies to other races, specifically Alaska Natives.
Yes. So European settlers killed millions of Indigenous people across America when they first came to America. And the fighting didn't stop after 1776. In fact, the last massacre of Indigenous peoples was at the Battle of Kelly Creek in Nevada, which was in 1911. And so from what I understand, critical race theory is important for all races, for all ethnic groups, not just Black Americans, because systemic racism affects all of us, including Alaska Natives. When they go to find land, to buy land, to buy a home, to get a fishing license, to get a gun license, all of that is a part of learning the history of critical race theory and why it's so important to know why they'd be discriminated against, why they would be, not be given that land that they want. And that's why it's so important to know the truth about how it is not just individuals, but institutions as well that impose racism upon people of Black and brown color.
I just find it so interesting that in the conversations that we're having, you know, we tend to think of it just that it applies to Black people, but it really is so much bigger than that. And we have a lot more in common with other races, and especially with the Alaska Native culture, than I think a lot of us realize.
We absolutely do. We absolutely do. And that's why I wanted to go back to the question you had before about American history in schools, because they don't have to learn critical race theory, but if they do learn properly American history, then they will learn about, for instance, a Trail of Tears, about how thousands and thousands of Indigenous peoples were pushed from their land, not nicely, like, please go over there, but violently and horribly treated. Many of them died and were relocated against their will. And it's so important that Indigenous peoples, including Alaska Natives, know what really happened, not just the older people, but the young people from the millennials and Generation Z. They need to know the truth about what happened to their ancestors so they can stand up and fight for their civil rights as well.
This is probably going to be a loaded question, but what would you say the call to action is for us as brown and Black people, and then for those who are white and who want to be a part of the solution here?
I think it's so important to just understand what civil rights means, what equal rights means, what systemic racism means, definition, first of all, so you are all standing on the same page, and then to have these conversations, and then to examine where civil rights is being taken away, or equal rights are being taken away, or systemic racism is being used to oppress people. I think then you have Black and brown people who run for office, who have a standing position in local communities and speak up. And I think for people who are not people of color to stand up and to speak up, one of the things that I smile every time I see in the news is a person who turns in their friend or family member who was a part of the January 6th insurrection, because it makes it impossible for them to hide in the shadows. It makes it impossible for them to hide in plain view. They have to be held accountable. And it starts with people who know people who are doing horrible things and who are allies with people who are being oppressed. That's where it starts. And that's how we can all work together and bring our country together. I really, truly believe that people who say, well, talking about CRT and talking about the 1619 Project and talking about racism divides our country. But that is incorrect. That is gaslighting, right? So the truth is hiding it, lying about it, pretending that it didn't happen, telling us to get over it. That is what divides our country. It's so painful to see right in front of us injustice being done and people not being held accountable. It's extremely painful for those who it affects, right? But it's more important that we stand up and we keep on fighting. And we keep fighting because we believe that if we do so, we will have true freedom, true equal rights, true civil rights, and we will be able to move this country forward. So I think that's how we do it.
Can you say a little bit more about the 1619 Project for those who are not familiar?
Yes. So let me just start by how I came upon that book. So Christmas last year, my parents, Carlos and Renee Boozer, they sent all of their children, who are all adults now, this book for Christmas. And I'd heard about it, but I'd never actually looked into it. So I wasn't clueless, but not fully understanding what they had given to us. So what the 1619 Project is, from what I'm understanding at this point, because I've only gotten a chapter 4, is it's a collection of historical scholars and people who have written about Black history from way back in the past. It's not new history. It's been there for decades. And it's a collection of that Black history and organized in this book. And it goes from 1619, which is the year that Black slaves were brought to Virginia. And they talk about how they were the very first slaves. And it goes all the way through to George Floyd. And it talks about how this country was built on the broken backs of Black Americans and how the wealth that was created from that slavery is what established America as a superpower. And from what I have read so far, you have African slaves and Black American slaves doing all the labor, doing all the hard work, but not receiving any of the monetary benefit, and that going to slave owners. And so when you look back at the richest families in this country, their riches came from slavery. And I think what it does, at least what it did for me, is it filled in the gaps. Growing up in Alaska, in the same schools that you and I went to back in the 80s and the 90s, we weren't taught the full story. We learned about Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks, and we had Black History Month, but we would have to go to the library and look up news articles if we wanted to see what else happened. You know, we had the Civil Rights Movement, but we didn't talk about Malcolm X. We didn't talk about the Black Panthers. We didn't talk about slavery in an in-depth way that made it more real for us as Black Americans. And what this book does is it fills in those gaps. It talks about the slave trade. It talks about where slavery began, which countries in Africa, because Africa is a continent with countries. It's not a country itself. It talks about which countries the slaves came from. It talks about the sugar cane. It talks about cotton. It talks about how the laws were made. It talks about every single aspect of Black history that is not covered in schools in a very full, well-rounded way. What I understand, it used to be, it began as New York Times article, and it became a book. And it's a collection of poetry by slaves. It has pictures of Black Americans from the 1900s and beyond. And it has literature. It has so many aspects of Black history that we were not taught, that is not being taught now, that would give you a better understanding of how racism has shaped this country and what we can do to end racism and move forward.
Wow. You know, what comes to mind when you say that is this TED Talk that I was listening to a few weeks ago, and I'll have to find the name of the gentleman who did it, but his whole TED Talk was based on his son coming home from school one day, and he was really excited, and the presenter, he was Black, and his son is too. And the son comes home and he's like, Dad, we learned about Rosa Parks today. And the gentleman said, oh, okay, well, what did you learn? And he said, well, we learned that she was a really, really old lady. And that one day she got on the bus and she was really, really tired at the end of a long, hard day. And the bus driver asked her to get up and move to the back of the bus. And because her feet hurt and she was so tired, she said that she wasn't going to get up and move. And he was infuriated because he's like, okay, this is the cutest dressed up little version of the Rosa Parks story that I have ever heard. And he was angry about it because he's like, I had to go back and actually re-educate my son. Like, Rosa Parks was not an old lady. She might have been 40 at that time. She was very capable, very healthy. Her feet were not hurting. She was not working in the fields or anything tired. She was a seamstress. And so he shared this really beautiful presentation about the difference between what really happened versus kind of like the pretty neat, tidy version that is being taught in schools today. And so it just goes right in line with what you're sharing and the changes that need to be made in order for us to educate our children and to move us forward as a society.
Yes, that's absolutely right. We call that whitewashing.
Right.
And they change history to yep. make it not sound as bad as it was.
Yeah, exactly. Like, she was just so old and feeble and decrepit, she didn't want to get up. Like, what? No, she was fighting for her rights is what she was doing. Well, is there anything else that we did not cover about critical race theory or anything surrounding that you think is important to share?
I just wanted to point out that critical race theory is important because, let's face it, racism didn't end when Barack Obama became president of the United States. And I think people think that it did, or some people think that it did, but it didn't. We need critical race theory so that we don't end up making the same mistakes that were made in the past and are still being made today. We need to stop this cycle of oppression and discrimination based on ignorance and false information. I think that what we are seeing is that racism is deeply rooted in American society and always has been. And it was even hidden in the way that laws were written. You know, one of the things that I wanted to speak on very quickly was that the Constitution was the original basis for slavery in the United States, dictating that slaves were 3/5 a person and that escaped slaves had to return to their owners. Though they abolished slavery around the world in 1794, it continued in America until 1865, until they passed the 13th Amendment. And so we as Black Americans have been free for only a small amount of time. And we were slaves for a much longer amount of time, for over 200 years. And we're still trying to figure out what civil rights is and what it means to us and what it means to Black and brown people of color. And I think that we have to keep fighting, because even though we have a rights movement, we're still fighting for our civil rights now in 2022. We're still fighting to make sure that Black and brown people get to have the proper right to vote. You know, one of the things that I love about Nevada is that voting is so easy here. It's unbelievably easy. They make it so easy for you. They are very accommodating. When it's time to vote, they send you a booklet that has every single issue and candidate being voted on. It breaks it down for you. And then when you go and vote, it's all touchscreen. It's very up to date. But back in Pennsylvania, where I used to live in Bucks County, when I first voted for President Obama, it was not like that. I was the only Black person voting, and I was terrified because everyone was looking at me like, I know what she's voting for because she's Black. And I was so scared, and it was so confusing. And so when I think about the experiences that I've had in Nevada with voting and in Pennsylvania with voting, even in California, it is abundantly clear to me that in some states, they make it very easy for you to find out who's running and what measures are being on the ballot. And in other states, make it very complicated and difficult so that you'll be intimidated not to vote or that you won't get it right. And I think the fact that they're trying to make it harder is a testament as to why it's so important for people of color and minorities to go out and vote, no matter how hard they try to make it to be. And so that's why it's so important to have CRT, to at least know what it is, to at least understand why it exists, why it began, how it's evolved, and how it can help our country. Instead of hearing the loud voices saying, they're trying to indoctrinate our children and make people hate America. I don't hate America. I love this country. I know as a Black woman, if I was born somewhere else, I would have less rights. And I know that being born and being an American citizen in this country means that I have more rights as a Black woman. And I'm very thankful for this country. I'm very patriotic, but I'm also not ignorant and naive about the truth of this country. And I think that's what's so important. You can know the truth and know the real history and what happened and still love this country and still be thankful for the rights that you are afforded, because people died for us to be able to sit here and talk about it. Because when you read 1619, you will learn that Black people were not allowed to even have a private conversation. It was against the law to do so. The fact that we can do that, we can vote, we can have our own businesses and make our own money is such a blessing, because it wasn't always like that. And only when you know where you came from can you move forward and not make the same mistakes. So to me, as a Black woman, that's why it's so important to know the truth and not believe the lie.
Amen. I'm going to go ahead and pause right here, and we're going to go to a quick break, Natasha. And when we come back, we're going to close out. Thank you to our listeners who have been with us today. I'm Christina Michelle, and you have been listening to Natasha Boozer. We're going to go to break, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Culture Rich Conversations. Today's show has been a conversation with Natasha Boozer, and we have been learning about critical race theory, what it is, why it's important. Natasha, thank you so much for your time and for your thoughts and your insight into this very broad topic.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I wanted to ask you before we go about your book, because you are an accomplished author, and you shared a little bit the last time that you were here about your book, The Palmer Women. You hinted that you had another project in the works, another book. Are you at liberty to share with us about that book before we go?
Yes. So the book is about my family and what it was like growing up in Juneau, Alaska, the time that we were there. And so what I did was I interviewed my parents and my siblings about what it was like growing up in Alaska, and in reference to how racism and race relations affected their lives. And I included my own story as well. And it's interesting because my sisters were children growing up in Alaska, and my brother Charles, youngest brother, was also a child. But I was, I think, a teenager before I left, and so was Carlos. My parents were adults. So I have different perspectives on what it was like to be a parent of children of color growing up in Alaska, and also being a child of color growing up in Alaska, and different experiences that everyone has experienced. So it's been a wonderful journey to get to know my family in this way. And I think that it will definitely speak to many other people of color who are growing up in mostly white suburbs or communities, and what it's like to grow up there and the things that you experience that you don't necessarily talk about, but can relate to. So I'm working on it. It's not finished by any means because it's seven people telling seven different stories. And it did take a little while to get everyone to turn in all of their answers. But now that I have it all, it's been a wonderful experience. And I think that it's going to help a lot of people feel less alone in the communities that they live in.
That is so awesome. Thank you so much. I can't wait until it's out. And for the Palmer women, if someone wants to read that book, where can they find it?
Oh, they can find the Palmer women anywhere the books are sold. On Amazon, on iBooks. It's available everywhere.
Okay, awesome. Well, Natasha, thank you again for being here. It's always a pleasure to speak with you, and I just love and adore you so much, and I appreciate all of your knowledge, your wisdom, your insight, and for being willing to share personal things about your life and your experiences as well.
Thank you so much. My hope is to help other people and to start a conversation that will hopefully make a difference. So I've had a great time, and I appreciate so, so much being invited back. And I thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk with you, because you know I miss you. And it blesses my heart to get to have this with one of my very best friends from childhood. And it tickles me that we get to do this as grownups, but and that we get to do it in a radio station in our hometown in Juneau, Alaska. That's so unbelievable to me. It brings me so much joy. So thank you for having me. I've had a wonderful time.
And to our listeners, we thank you for joining us. Culture Rich Conversations is on every Thursday during a Juneau afternoon at 3 o'clock and again at 7 o'clock. If you have any feedback or any ideas of things that you would like to hear us talk about on the show, please feel free to reach out to us on Facebook. And you can also send an email to junobaa@gmail.com. And until next week, this is Christina Michelle. It's been a pleasure being your host.